From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. Along with your calls, some topics to talk about, Zorba?
Yes, breathing through your nose, breathing through your mouth is one better for making memories. And what does this have to say about meditation and things of that nature? And standing desks, are they overrated? Or should we all be standing at our desk? Maybe we should be standing at our microphone right now instead of sitting here.
I have an opinion on that.
Yes, I bet you do. I bet you do.
And a recipe.
Maple roasted carrots with goat cheese. You know, this time of year, frankly, any time of year, I'm often looking for a side dish, especially if I'm going to someone's house with a dish to pass, and I want to bring something that's veggie, that's unique, that tastes good. This is it. Simple, easy, great for this time of year.
I'm really looking forward to that.
It's really good.
Again, the number is 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. And to the phones we go now, Zorba, a listener with us in Denver, Colorado. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
So, I am 22 years old, but when I was 18 years old, I had this weird episode where I got numbing in my hands and my limbs. I had blurred vision. I had slurred speech. Mm-hmm. I felt very distant from kind of my brain, mm-hmm. and this happened when I was in school. And I seemed to be, it mm-hmm. seemed kind of like a stroke, but I seemed to be fine after.
Mm-hmm.
And these episodes have happened about twice a year, mm-hmm. and they still happen. Most uh-huh. recently, this happened, and I actually had a fainting spell before the symptoms came on.
And so, tell me about the fainting spell a bit for a second. Tell me exactly. Yeah. I mean, replay for us the story of where you were, what you were doing when that occurred.
Mm-hmm. So I was on the light rail. It was a pretty hot day in Denver, mm-hmm. so it could have been related to some type of dehydration, mm-hmm. but. I was coming into this light rail station pretty fast. I was standing up because I had my bicycle, mm-hmm. and I had this kind of wave come over me of just, uh-huh. like, relief. But the next thing I knew, I was on the ground.
Wow.
And a pedestrian was helping me, and I had a gash on my eye.
Uh-huh.
And shortly after that, I kind of came to, and these symptoms came on again that mm-hmm. I get about twice a year.
Wow.
And so I went to the hospital, and had some tests done.
Mm-hmm.
Everything came back normal, which has been pretty common in these circumstances.
Yeah. What tests were done besides blood tests? What other tests?
I had a electrocardiogram, I think. Mm-hmm. It was on my heart.
Okay, so they did an EKG to look at the heart rhythm.
Yes.
I'm sure they checked your blood sugar to see if it was a blood sugar issue, checked your blood count. What else? Anything else?
I think they checked my water levels,
mm-hmm.
but maybe that was part of a blood test.
Yeah, it was a blood test to check your sodium and everything else. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. Everything really came back normal.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
the weird thing is that my siblings, my two sisters, have also had episodes like this. And so we really don't know what the deal is.
Oh, I've got an idea. I have an idea of what
I
think
it is. Let me jump in before you do. Is there a party going on at your place?
Not particularly. I'm in a library.
Wait a second.
You're
libraries.
Supposed to be quiet in a library.
Library is supposed to be quiet. Boy, they sure have changed libraries since
okay.
I was a kid. Our librarian, you know, especially the librarian around Chicago, if you took a deep breath and it was too loud, they'd come over and hit you with like a ruler. And
well,
say,
now, before Zorba answers your question, tell those people to shut up.
No. That is not very nice, Tom. Be quiet as they're in the chat. I have an idea of what this is, by the way. So
okay,
I'm going to give you a distinct idea. There are a couple of things that immediately come to mind. First of all, the fact that your sisters have had the same thing pretty much to me cinches what I think is most likely the diagnosis. But I want to ask you a question. Do you get headaches at all?
I don't. And
okay.
And really, headaches weren't really a part of my childhood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I would say even when these when these episodes happen,
uh-huh.
there's sometimes a slight little twinge
mm-hmm.
in my temple, but
mm-hmm.
it really, Yeah, it really doesn't act up at all.
Okay, there are two tests that generally we do situations like this to rule out stuff. So first of all, we want to look at cardiac issues. Sometimes we'll do an echocardiogram, and an echocardiogram actually looks at the valves of the heart and whether or not anything is going on and flopping out from a cardiac point of view. An EKG looks at the electrical part, but an echocardiogram is different. Sometimes we'll do an echocardiogram. I don't know whether or not you need that in this case, but what I think you need to do is two things. You need to make sure this is not a seizure, so you need to see a neurologist and have an EEG, a sleep-deprived EEG, which is where we keep you up all night and then do it and make sure it's not a seizure. I don't think this is a seizure, by the way, but a sleep-deprived EEG will rule it out. I think this is a migraine variant. Mm-hmm. Migraines can do exactly what you have happening to you. It is not uncommon. It is an issue. You can have migraines without any pain at all within the headache, and people have things that are seizure-like, rather stroke-like activity, and in fact, they're migraine headaches, and that's what it possibly is. So a neurologist really answers this question by looking at an EEG, doing an evaluation. The fact that your sisters have had the same thing to me cinches that migraines are the most likely diagnosis.
Okay.
And then there are things you can do about it. If you have migraines and they bother you, you can be on beta blockers. There's a drug called topiramide, which is used for seizures, but in small doses, it's very good for migraine headaches. So there are things that you can do about this if it's migraine. But this sounds like a migraine to me. And it wouldn't be picked up on any of the tests that they did in the emergency room because they wouldn't be looking for a migraine headache. They wouldn't have done that workup.
Okay.
I think it's a migraine headache.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Good luck. Let us know what happens. This sounds like a migraine. If I'm a sleuth in the Agatha Christie tradition, I would fit. This fits with migraines, the destiny of migraines.
We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, before our next call, some research on nose breathers compared with mouth breathers.
Are you a mouth breather or a nose breather?
No, I don't remember ever seeing a mouth breather.
No, but when you have a cold, don't you breathe through your mouth?
No.
Well, obviously you don't, if you don't think about
it. I don't get that kind of
cold. Oh, no, if I get a bad cold, all of a sudden I breathe through my mouth and I hate it because my mouth gets dry. Mm. And some people breathe through their mouth versus their nose. They've had maybe they've gotten into a fight. You know, they can't breathe through their nose or their nose is stuffy from allergies or some surgery or something else. There are people who breathe through their mouth all the time. And they don't breathe through their nose. And often they breathe somewhat through their nose. But this is a very interesting study. And it's a very small study. So you've got to look at small studies and say, what are they? Now, if we look basically at a lot of spiritual traditions such as meditation, it's sitting there, quieting your mind, thinking about breathing, often breathing in through your nose, out through your nose, and some concentration. So the question was, from these researchers in Sweden, whether or not nose breathing or mouth breathing made a difference in terms of memory. Now, the interesting thing about the nose is when you breathe through the nose and you activate the olfactory bulb in the brain, that's the part of the brain that recognizes smells. It's right next to the hippocampus, which is an area of the brain which we think of. It's not really – the hippocampus does a lot of things, but among other things, it's really where a lot of memory activities and the storage of memory activities are involved. So they took 12 people. They were men and women volunteers. They were young, healthy adults. And they actually looked at smells. Mm-hmm. So they said, here's the smell of an orange. Here's the smell of a grapefruit. Here's a few other scents that you don't know what they are, smell things. Mm-hmm. And then the subjects, they wanted the subjects to memorize the smells. Okay, we want you to memorize the smells. And then we're going to come back and give you the smells, and you tell us, is this an orange smell or another smell? So they're using the olfactory bulb to actually do it. So they sat quietly for an hour. They had tape over their mouths to prevent mouth breathing, or they had their nose clipped, so their nose was clipped so they would breathe through their mouth, or their mouth was basically taped over so they would breathe through their nose. Mm-hmm. Okay? And then what they did is they came back an hour later, presented the smells to the volunteers and said, which smells do we have? Okay? And lo and behold, the people who actually, for that 1 hour, were breathing through their nose and weren't smelling anything, they were able to recall those scents. And they did much, much better on the test than the people who were breathing through their mouth, okay? Just in regular air, breathing through their mouth. So the nose breathers were able to remember the scents better than the mouth breathers. Now, the question then is, what does this mean? Now, you're smiling right now.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Isn't this really obvious? Why do you need research on this?
No, the question was, they're breathing in between. They're sitting for an hour with regular air. They're breathing through their nose in one case, breathing through their mouth in another case, and then what scent do they remember? And the ones who breathe through their nose remember
more. But if you're used to breathing through your nose, obviously the nose picks up scents better.
Are you telling me this is a junk study? Now, wait a second. Okay. I'm trying to make the best of this. I'm trying to look through science and see that this is something that it's useful, that you remember things better if you breathe through the nose. And you're telling me it's baloney?
And you said a small study. What did you say, 7 people?
No, 12.
12
there were
people.
12 people. Well, all right. Okay. On to the next call. What can I say?
1-800-462-7413.
I'm trying to make the best out of science. That's what I'm trying to do.
800-462-7413. Back to the phones we go. A listener with us now in Moni, Illinois.
I thought it was a good study.
Moni,
hi. Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Fine. How can we help?
I'm a driver, and I love driving at night. And my issue is my day consists of about 12 hours. Basically, when I get to the terminal, from there when I leave the terminal, by the time I get to my spot where I deliver and then come back, it's about a 12-hour day. So during the nighttime, I tend to lose a little energy. So I'm trying to find some type of supplement, something that can give me some energy. I don't want to drink an energy drink or none of that 5-hour stuff. Nothing like that. I'm looking for a supplement that can help me, you know, stay alert and give me some more energy at night.
Tell me what your typical pattern is with like sleep and wakefulness. Just give me a typical day for you.
I leave the house about 9.
Okay.
At night, I get home about maybe 10 or 11. I try to eat a light meal, but I tend to not do. And then I end up going to sleep about maybe 1-ish.
Okay, and then how long do you sleep?
Periodically getting up, using the bathroom every 2 hours. I might sleep about 5 hours. Okay. I might get up about 7 o'clock.
Okay, so you sleep about 5 hours. Do you nap do you ever nap, by the way?
Well, actually, when I get up, I take my break.
Yeah.
At night, I take about a 30-minute or 45-minute nap at night. That's my break.
Okay. And that, by the way, is extremely important for energy. I mean, that's the important thing is one of the things you do, especially with anyone who works either shift work or if they work in a reverse sort of time of daytime and nighttime, taking that nap can make a huge difference. And making sure the nap isn't too long, like you said, less than 45 minutes. If you get to an hour and a half, you're in a REM sleep. It's very deep. It's a different kind. Sometimes it can be too much. But a good 20 to 40-minute nap in the middle of the day is going to give you some energy. Part of this is an eating issue. So how many hours, now let's think about it for a second. How many hours do you go without eating anything, you know, without having a meal, we'll say? How many hours is that? You know, a lot of times people, for instance, who have daytime job, they'll stop eating at 10 o'clock at night. They won't eat until 12 o'clock the next day. So basically they've gone 14 hours without eating. And that's a biggie. So do you have a breakfast before you go to work, your work? A breakfast, meaning a meal?
Yes, And it's pretty...
Is it too much? Do you eat too much at that time?
To me, it's a nice-sized meal, but it's a little bit overboard.
That's part of the energy issue. If you have too much in your stomach, too much for your pancreas to work on, too much blood sugar that's going too high because of carbohydrates and other foods you're eating, it's going to sap you from energy.
Yeah, can you tell us what your breakfast usually is, what you eat?
Okay, because I work at night, I try to, because I'm also overweight, so I'm trying to lose some weight also. I used to come home in the morning and I would eat like a I like cereal, banana. I try to eat a light meal, but lately I find myself coming home eating heavy, and then I go to sleep, and I wake up feeling miserable. So my breakfast meal is really not that great either. You know, I can honestly say I think part of my problem is my eating habits.
You hit it right on the head. You hit it right on the head. So I've got a couple of suggestions that you should do for about a 6-week period. You should move as much as you can to a vegetarian diet. And the reason is vegetarian diet will have, on the whole, if you're not eating, when I say vegetarian, I don't mean that you're eating sugary drinks for a vegetarian as part of the fruit. You stay away from fruit juice. You have whole fruits. You have fruits and vegetables. If you're going to have protein and you're going to have meat and fish, eat more fish than meat. Eat it in smaller amounts. Look at your calories throughout the day and instead try to change your dietary activity so you're not eating large amounts suddenly and stressing your pancreas and upping your blood sugar. And if you go to a more vegetarian diet with whole grains and whole foods that is then basically digested throughout the day, you will have more energy. It's a dietary issue. And you're right to say, I don't want the energy drinks. I don't want to have too much caffeine. The energy drinks are loaded with caffeine. So you may get a buzz from the caffeine, but as a driver, you're going to get the down after the caffeine is out of your system. I mean, a moderate amount of caffeine is fine, but a super amount of caffeine produces, hills and valleys. And the hills, when it makes you energized, that's great, but the valley is really deep. So you need a more vegetarian diet for about a 6-week period. Take your calories, spread them throughout the time. You want to look at your breakfast, your lunch, and your dinner, whatever that is. Remember, we associate cereal because it's in the morning, and that's because old Kellogg of Kellogg Cornflakes said you do that in the morning. In France, for instance, they eat eggs all, morning, afternoon, and evening. And in the U.S., if you have eggs, if I say, let's have eggs at night, my wife goes, are you sick? She doesn't say we should have it. But you should look at that. Eggs are a great source of protein. Doesn't have to be a pure vegetarian diet. But you need less concentrated foodstuffs. You are eating too much, and you're eating them in concentrated part, and that is sapping your energy. The nap, by the way, is awesome. Keep the nap in there. Critical.
Oh, yeah. Most definitely. I eat too much meat. I really mm-hmm. do. Yeah, I eat a lot of meat.
Cut it down.
Those Hostess cupcakes, things like that, sugary things.
Well, you've got to change that. You've got to see what you've got to do is experiment and find things to see if you get more energy, and then that will motivate you to have a better diet. Because, like you said, you're overweight, you want to lose weight, and it's sapping your energy. And if you don't change your diet, you're looking at the wrong place. And like you said, you're staying away from the energy drinks. So diet. And when I say diet, I don't mean you need to be on a diet. I mean you need to eat better.
I understand.
Well, good luck.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time, and thanks for having me, okay?
You're welcome. Thank you. You take care.
Call at 800-462-7413. Before the break now, Zorba, let's check in again with your favorite nitpickers.
Oh, no.
And backseat drivers, the Grammar Police.
You know, I think some people tune into the show just trying to catch me on my grammar, and they don't care about anything else. That's what I think.
Well, this one, Zorba, is actually from the Power Tool Police.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
A listener named Pam sent us the following email. Zorba, first, I love your show. But on a recent episode, you were talking about how to get rid of nail fungus, and you mentioned you could Dremel your nails. Mm-hmm. The word is actually Dremel.
Oh, my goodness. I can't believe it. I mispronounced Dremel as Dremel. Oh, Miss Schutte, my eighth grade teacher, I can just imagine her turning over in her grave. She was a thin person to begin with, so she would probably be thin without all of her stuff on her body now. But she would turn over in her grave. She always corrected my grammar. Dremel?
You said Dremel.
Did I say Dremel? And it's Dremel.
Dremel, yeah.
Oh, okay. Dremel. That's a word thing, isn't it, Dremel?
I never heard
it. You don't know what either one of those Dremel. You don't even know. Do you know what a Dremel is? You don't even know what a Dremel is. And I bet you most of the other people don't. It's a little whirly thing. It's kind of like a drill that goes into your tooth. Remember the dentist would put a drill? But it doesn't. It sands the top of the nail. Dremel.
Yep.
Dremel.
Did something Zorba say really grind your gears?
Oh, gosh.
Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More of your calls coming up. A delicious recipe, too, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again, if you have a question for Zorba, 1-800-462-7413.
Yeah, you say that so well, Tom. Can you repeat that a number? 1-800. Go ahead. 1-800.
After all these years, I should be able to say the phone.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But it's the way you say it. I mean, it's just endearing.
800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, before our next call, our recipe, maple roasted carrots with goat cheese.
Okay. Do you like carrots?
I do.
Yeah. See, and I happen to like carrots.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read you 3 fun facts about carrots. I'm going to read it to you, and you're going to give me your reaction, okay?
Okay.
So the first fun fact, I got this from WebMD, by the way. Carrots are low in calories, high in nutrition, and delicious. Yes or no?
Yeah.
I asked you to respond. Okay, yeah. That's very good. Okay, here's the first use. People first grew carrots as medicine, not food, for a variety of ailments. Did you know
really?
That?
No, of course I
had no idea either. I thought that carrots were always, so they did it. So carrots are really part of, like, how do you make yourself healthier? You know, and we think of it as healthier with our body, but they grew it as medicine, okay? Here's the next fun fact. Carrots can be traced back about 5,000 years through historical documents and paintings. 5,000 years. No one knows exactly when the first carrots appeared because many people mistook them for parsnips, which are a close relative of carrots. What do you think about that?
It's kind of ridiculous.
That's right. But anyway, parsnips look like carrots. I use parsnips in my chicken soup. In other words, carrots, parsnips, they look the same on paintings and other things. Okay. Now here is the fifth fact.
Wait a minute. What is with the paintings, did you say?
Well, that's how do you think they knew that people 5,000 years ago were eating carrots? They wrote it down, had a carrot today, liked it? No, paintings, drawings. They had carrots in them.
Somebody made a painting of somebody else eating a carrot?
Well, maybe they made a painting of a carrot. I don't know. I'm just telling you.
Okay.
They knew it through painting. Here's the fifth fun fact.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Mel Blanc, the voice of the cartoon character Bugs Bunny.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Hated carrots. Astounding. That's right. What's up, Doc? And every time he probably did it, he thought, I'm not going to really eat this. That's right. He hated carrots, reportedly.
That's kind of fun.
It was like George Bush, who hated broccoli. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Ate broccoli. He hated carrots.
Well, I kind of like both, but I don't like broccoli anywhere near as much as I like carrots.
The fact is, we eat more carrots than we eat broccoli. Broccoli is like, I'm making broccoli tonight. Carrots are like you take it out of the refrigerator and you eat a carrot.
Yeah.
I mean, what's up, Doc?
What's up is we've got to get to the recipe.
Okay, Tom, we'll get to the recipe. Maple roasted carrots with goat cheese. Okay. Now, what I like about this recipe, it's simple. It's easy. You can bring it for a dish to pass. Next time you go to a soccer party, Tom, you can bring this to a dish to pass.
A soccer party? Where'd you come up with that?
It came out of my brain because that was a lot of dishes to pass. Okay. Start out with 3 pounds of baby carrots halved.
3 pounds of baby carrots halved.
Yeah, the nice thing I like about carrots now is that I don't have to go through the process of, you know, putting them in the sink and taking care of, you know, the outside of the carrot. I can just buy them in, you know, plastic bags, which I really like.
And baby carrots is a good idea.
Oh, baby carrots are great. They're small. They're tasty to me. They're kind of juicier. I like them better.
Yeah.
A quarter cup of maple syrup.
Quarter cup maple syrup.
And use maple syrup. Don't use Log Cabin, which is like 5% maple syrup. And I might be wrong, maybe more than 5%. Might not have any maple syrup in there. It might be all artificial flavoring. But it's certainly not maple syrup. It's fake maple syrup. Yeah. You want real maple syrup, which costs money. Yeah. And the maple syrup comes from probably Vermont or Canada or Wisconsin. Or in my case, will come from my neighbor who makes their own maple syrup. And it's wonderful. It's just great. It has a nice sort of smoky flavor to it. 3 tablespoons. Spoonfuls of extra virgin olive oil.
3 big tea extra virgin olive oil.
We're halfway through the recipe. It's an easy recipe. Mm-hmm. Teaspoon of kosher salt.
Little tea kosher salt.
Kosher salt is much better for this. It doesn't have sodium silicate or calcium silicate, whatever it is in regular sort of salt that makes it move. Mm-hmm. Quarter of a cup of crumpled goat cheese.
Quarter cup. Crumpled goat cheese.
Yeah, any kind of goat cheese. You can use feta. You can use a sheep cheese if you want to, but it's got to be this full-flavored things. And 3 tablespoonfuls of chopped chives.
3 big tea chopped chives. Right,
so you've got a few things to buy at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's make the recipe. 2 things. That's all we have to do. Number one, preheat the oven. You could do that, Tom.
Okay.
And a large baking sheet. Toss the carrots, which have been halved, with the maple syrup, the olive oil, and the salt. Got it?
A correction, though.
Yeah?
I don't know how to work our oven.
You know how you work your oven? You call Mickey. Come on. That's how you do. Turn on the oven.
Yeah.
Okay. Roast it for 15 minutes until they're tender, about 15 minutes. Remove it from the oven. Transfer to a serving platter. Then garnish with goat cheese on the top. And garnish with some chives on the chop. You're done on the top. So you got the goat cheese on the chop. The chives, it's really, really nice. It's a delicious dish to have. And it's really good. It's another way to eat carrots. Now, if you want a copy of this, you can find it, guess where, Tom? Yeah, it's right, on the web. That's exactly it. Go to ZorbaPastor.org or find us through Facebook. It's Maple Roasted Carrots with Goat Cheese. Delicious this time of year, and actually delicious any time of year.
Yeah, what are those things? Web and...
That's right. And electricity.
800-462-7413 is our number. That's 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, a listener joins in from San Diego, California. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I'm a healthy 81-year-old male.
Uh-huh.
I don't take any medication except an occasional Motrin. Mm-hmm. So I'm a prime candidate to get into old people's studies. Mm-hmm. And I've been in a lot of them, different kinds, often looking at Alzheimer's and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And the one I'm in now is looking at the amyloid protein, is that what it's called?
Amyloid protein plaques for Alzheimer's.
And I've been in another one that did that, and they were going to figure out if I had the amyloid protein after giving me a bunch of questions about if I know what day it is and who's the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to determine it by a PET scan.
Uh-huh.
And so I got all the way to the point where I was supposed to take the PET scan, and the pill that they were using in the study turned out to cause liver disease, which was one of the side effects of the pill, presumably, and so they canceled the study.
Of course. So as soon as they found that out, they found that out, they said, we're not going to continue the study from a safety point of view.
Right. So I entered another one that's conducted by a major university in San Diego and the BA, and I went through all of the test to see if I knew what 2 and 2 was, you know, see if I had all this already. And I don't, apparently. Uh-huh. And the way they were going to find the amyloid protein was a cerebral fluid, spinal fluid draw, lumbar puncture, something like that.
Okay, so they're looking for some protein in the CSF, cerebral spinal fluid.
And so I'm all set to do it, but I'm really nervous about it because I don't like invasive procedures, and I have never had a spinal tap. I guess that's how they do it.
Right.
And it's scary. So I read about it, you know, like I do. Went to Google, checked everything, and it scared me even more.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of side effects that are possible. I realize side effects are small, but I kind of apply a risk-benefit, and I almost think there's more risk than benefit to me.
Well, there's not much benefit to you. There's no benefit
to
you.
Correct.
I mean, the reality is you don't...
But even the benefit of helping people, I don't mind that.
Right. There may be a benefit to society, because your data might help essentially develop other medications that may help. We may understand more about it. But the reality is you don't get any individual benefit from having a spinal tap. And it is invasive. I mean, you know, the first thing we think about is pain and discomfort. And the risks are small, but they're risks. I mean, it's not exactly like drawing blood. It's drawing fluid from the CSF, and something could happen. So your question is what?
Should I do it?
That's a very interesting question. So what's happening is with the PET scan, we really don't have a way of exactly discovering if there's amyloid in the brain without opening up your skull and taking a biopsy. You know, and obviously, obviously we don't do that. So we don't do it. So we look for other kinds of markers for the amyloid protein. And they may be looking either for amyloid. I'm not sure exactly what they're looking for, but I would conjecture they're looking for amyloid in the CSF or some marker that assumes there may be amyloid. Or they may be just looking for a bunch of things and say, hey, we've got cerebral spinal fluid from a young, healthy 81-year-old. And young, I mean, you know, young, not young in age. 81 is 81. But the fact is you're really doing well at 81. And this is the CSF of somebody doing well at 81. Here's the cerebral spinal fluid of somebody who's doing poorly. Is there a difference? And they may say, hey, there's no difference at all. Looks the same, which means that the cerebral spinal fluid test is worthless because you got somebody who's demented that may have or memory loss, they may have the same, you know, fluid may look the same as somebody who has no memory loss at all. That means the fluid is not a marker for anything. And they're looking at it. The thing about studies, and let me tell you, I did clinical research for 35 years. And so I am very familiar with that and with informed consent. You should not feel bad about saying you're not going to do the test. And when they actually do studies, they know a certain number of people, and that's how they actually design the studies, are going to say when they get to the test, I don't want to have it done. And you have to think about what's in your best interest for yourself and for society, and then make that decision yourself. But you should not have guilt figure into that decision. So would I do it at the age of 81? That would be a hard decision. It would not. That would be a hard decision. I would have a PET scan done, but when I think about it, I wouldn't have a CSF done. I wouldn't have it done. I would say, especially since it's early and it's elementary, and I wouldn't have it done. I guess that's my answer. I mean, I'm thinking about it. That's what I would say.
I love the answer because it gives me a chance to get a second opinion from you that matches the first opinion from my wife.
From your wife. Hey, this would have been a Judge Zorba. We've got it, you see. Well, now let me circle back to this. If my wife said no, I wouldn't even consider it. Because if I had a side effect, she would be incredibly upset. And then she would be really upset that I made this decision, and now I'm having side effects from the decision. And it wouldn't be appropriate in our relationship because I would respect her for her decision.
Well, I just always like your program so much, and I'm so glad to talk to you and get your opinion. And my wife will listen, and she'll be happier than I am.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much
for sharing that.
We really appreciate that call at 800-462-7413. And before the break now, Zorba, we love it when our listeners post on the Facebook page, Zorba Pastor on Your Health. So let's get social and fire up the segment we call Facebook Feedback.
Facebook feedback.
Okay, Zorba, here's a post that came from a listener named Beth. She wrote, "Hi, Dr. Z. I'm curious if you've discussed intermittent fasting for weight loss and diabetes control."
Well, the answer is we have discussed it before in the past, and it's quite interesting. Certainly, you are doing no harm to yourself at all. There's some people who believe it's much better for your pancreas, and if it gets you to lose weight, do it.
Okay, have a healthy living question for the good doc. Just post on our Facebook page, or you can always send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org. What is email anyway?
I'm supposed to be asking that question. More of your calls coming up, another interesting topic to discuss, and our medical Mythbuster segment. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, why standing desks are overrated?
Yeah, well, and they may be overrated. You know, so I don't know about you, but you may have noticed, certainly in a number of offices and certainly in my clinic, some people are in standing desks.
Oh, it's certainly the trend. Yeah,
definitely a trend. There's no trend about it. And standing desks, by the way, you get a standing desk, it's not cheap. I mean, you have to buy it. They're newly manufactured. And it may be like bottled water. You know, it's something that people are pushing. Now, I'm of the belief that sitting is the new smoking. It's not exactly the case. Smoking is far, far worse than sitting. But it's a good rallying cry. I remember one of my trainers said sitting is the new smoking. And that's because there are a number of studies that have shown that people who sit a lot are not in as good a shape. In fact, there was a study in 2015 of more than 150,000 older adults. At the start of the study, they looked at, you know, how they were doing, and they found that people who sat more on the whole died sooner. They lost roughly 2.5 to 3 years of age. And so there are a bunch of other studies that have shown the same thing.
Well, although, then standing desks aren't overrated.
Well, but then you say, you look at sitting and you look at standing and what's in between, it's called exercise. So standing is not exercise, it's standing. There's a difference. And when we stand, we're using our body in a different way. And there are a number of studies that have shown, for instance, for people who are more likely to have varicose veins, that it may worsen varicose veins. Mm-hmm. People who have back pain may benefit from standing, but not standing too much. A lot of people with back pain actually benefit from standing and sitting in an alternating way. But standing is not exercise. And also, the studies that when you look at the studies, and these are, once again, these are observational studies, people who sit more often tend to be people who don't have as much money. In other words, when you're looking at 150,000 people or 100,000 people, the people who don't have as much access to other things tend to have more poverty. So what we may be looking at, sitting might actually be a marker for poverty and the lack of the ability to actually go and do exercise versus standing. So the issue about standing is this. Number one, if standing makes you feel better and it feels better for your body, absolutely do it. A lot of people with back pain do better. If you think standing is a substitute for exercise, you are thinking wrong. That standing is maybe better for you than sitting, but it may be overrated because standing is not exercise. So it's not get off your butt and exercise. It's stop standing around and doing nothing and get out and exercise. And that's the bottom line.
Okay, doing nothing doesn't include calling, so give us a call at 800-462-7413, 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, a listener in Williamsville, New York, joins us. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I'm interested in Nicorette gum. I'm in contact with a young person who has never been a smoker, now, I have found out, enjoys smoking or chewing Nicorette gum. And I'm concerned that this can lead to a nicotine addiction at some point, even though they're not a smoker. So I wondered if the doctor has any opinion on this.
Well, you're right, by the way. It definitely, people who chew, and that's I've never read any studies about this. It's rather interesting. I know that people who quit smoking and used a Nicorette gum, and, of course, all the generics around Nicorette gum, about 5% continue to smoke it. So we know that 5 or 10% continue to smoke it, and it controls their nicotine addiction. I mean, they have the gum, and the gum doesn't seem to cause any dental problems at all. It doesn't cause any cardiovascular problems. We feel, you know, medically, from a safety point of view, it's far better than smoking. And to my knowledge, I've never seen anything that said it actually is deleterious. But if somebody never smoked and started chewing Nicorette gum and can't stop, they do have a nicotine addiction, yes.
Well, this seems to be a college thing. Kids do.
Yeah. Well, people often get addicted to all sorts of things when they're in high school and when they're in college. And you look down at college campuses, and there are a number of college campuses where very intelligent people sit around and smoke cigarettes. And when I was in college, I smoked cigarettes. I still look back at that, and I go, really? I smoked for 4 years? That's a long time that I smoked cigarettes in college because I thought I was smarter, and I was sitting around. I was so cool. I was smoking cigarettes. Well, of course, in those days, we didn't know that cigarettes were that bad for you. But the reality is, I knew they caused lung cancer, but I was in my 20s. I didn't care about lung cancer. I was stupid like everybody else. Well, chewing nicotine gum is and getting addicted to it is a dumb, stupid thing to do. And if you want to give advice to that person, the answer is yes, you're addicted to it. You ought to try to, you know, wean yourself off of it over time because it can become a lifelong habit. But I've never looked at the data. I'm sure there's studies that look at people who then just become addicted de novo, as we would say from that. So it's a college thing in your area for kids to smoke nicotine gum?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was the first I had ever heard of it. Mm-hmm. So my, you know, reaction was like, why are you doing that?
But right.
I thought, I don't know anything either. And I really don't know about nicotine addiction. I was a smoker, mm-hmm. but I could give up cigarettes for weeks. But then I'd go to a girl party or something and pick it up again.
You clearly were not addicted.
If
you could give it up for weeks and then you could go back and forth and you could give it up without a problem, if you were addicted, it was surely a mild addiction. Now, it took me 4 times to quit smoking. More times. Uh-huh. And I still have the memory. If I talk about it like I'm doing right now, I can smell the smoke. I can feel the buzz of the cigarette. I can see the yellow on my finger. There's no yellow on my finger because I'm not smoking. And I can feel it in my hand. And I think about this, and I quit in 1969.
Wow, and memory lingers.
Oh, the memory lingers because clearly I'm an addict, you know, the memory lingers. But, I mean, I would never, you know, smoke, obviously. But if I were addicted to nicotine gum and I started chewing, no one would notice that I'm chewing nicotine or Nicorette gum versus chewing regular gum.
But I don't know the symptoms of nicotine addiction. I mean, obviously, when you're smoking a cigarette and somebody lights up one right after another, you know they have a problem. Uh-huh. However, what does nicotine do
well,
to you?
Well, if you're continuing to smoke it all the time and you have to smoke it, you're addicted. Nicotine is a buzz. I mean, you get a buzz. Certainly you get a buzz
from
cigarettes. And you might feel better and you like it. And nicotine is a highly addictive substance. It is the most highly addictive substance on earth. And there is no other plant. Maybe the morphine molecule might be part of it. You know, you think about the number of molecules and plants that we're addicted to. It's very few. We're addicted to alcohol, you know, which comes from a variety of plant products or artificially made. We're addicted to the morphine molecule in various ways, and we're addicted to nicotine. There are very few things that actually addict human beings, but more people are addicted to nicotine than anything else. So they may feel healthy, but the reality is if you have to do it all the time, it ain't good.
Correct. Okay. I appreciate that insight.
Thank you so much for the call.
I was a pipe smoker for a long time, a number of years.
Right, you were. I remember
maybe decades.
Right.
And I was sitting outside on the patio smoking my pipe and then said to myself, I don't want to do this anymore. So I gathered up all my pipes, threw them in the garbage.
Oh, really?
Huh. And I never smoked again.
And never smoked again. So it was easy for you to quit once you made that decision. Did you go through any withdrawal at all?
No, nothing.
Oh, interesting.
And you I always thought since I didn't inhale that it was not as harmful as cigarettes.
I think we had a president who once said I didn't inhale, but that was a different that was a different substance.
800-462-7413. 1-800. I was telling the
truth. See, history lesson. We have the history police who will come up next.
800-462-7413. Zorba time now for our medical Mythbuster segment. This email came to us from a listener named Irene in Ship Rock, New Mexico. She writes, Dr. Zorba, I am lactose intolerant, and on a trip to Vienna, Austria, my friends and I decided to get ice cream from a street vendor. I told the vendor that I couldn't eat ice cream because it bothers my stomach. She looked at me very serious and said, I'm supposed to do an Austrian accent.
Good,
now.
Try it. I do it.
I have no idea.
Come on, try it. Try it. Try it. Kind of German.
Is that it?
Try
okay.
it. Go ahead. Try to
she
do
looked
it.
At
I bet
me
you
and,
can do it.
She looked at me and said, I tell you, if you have beer mit every meal, you will not have problems mit your stomach. I guarantee. I know that's not an Austrian accent.
Hey, you know what? To my 3.5-year-old grandchild, you would sound Austrian.
I just tried to sound silly, and it didn't come off Austrian. So later in Germany, I decided to give it a try when we were at a restaurant.
Uh-huh.
I ordered a beer and saved it until the ice cream came. I drank the beer while eating the ice cream, and I actually had no stomach problems.
Uh-huh.
When I got back home, I immediately went to the store, bought some ice cream, and ate it while drinking a Guinness.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed to work then as well. Since then, I've tried to only eat ice cream if I can also have a beer with it. My question is this. Is this in my head, or is there really some truth in beer's value as a digestive aid? And by the way, beer and ice cream together, it doesn't taste that bad.
Well, my answer is, does it really matter? Does it really matter if you can drink a beer and have ice cream? But if you're having ice cream in the middle of the day or you're having ice cream three times a day, you've got to give it a second thought. I have no idea.
I can't imagine
beer
and ice cream.
I have no idea. But the reality is, whatever it is, the beer settled your stomach, or it did something to your brain because you got a buzz from the beer, and then the ice cream didn't bother you. You know what? Enjoy. Some things science doesn't really care about. And by the way, Tom, I got to tell you something. Your accent sucked.
I knew that. Didn't I say that? You don't have to anyway. Have a potential myth for Zorba. First, drink a beer.
Yes, right. That's
then
right.
Post it on our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba at WPR. See, I can hardly say it because I'm thinking about the Guinness. Zorba at WPR.org.
800-462-7413 is our number, 800-462-7413. Now, before we head out today, Zorba, let's pry open the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and share a listener email. This one came to us from a listener named Luke. Dr. Zorba, my wife and I are both obese and have been living a low-carb lifestyle for about 6 months. It's been wonderful for our general health, and the weight loss has been significant, 50 pounds each.
Oh, my goodness.
However,
wow.
However, my wife is also diagnosed as a type 2 diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of weeks ago, we found out my wife was pregnant. Woo-hoo!
Mm-hmm.
Her maternal fetal medicine team is telling her that she must stop her low-carb lifestyle for the safety of the baby's development. And they are recommending she increase her carb intake ninefold, 45 to 60 grams per meal. We don't understand how something, the low-carb lifestyle, that has proven to be immensely beneficial to us can be harmful for the baby. Please help us advocate for the baby and our low-carb lifestyle.
Well, I'm going to advocate for the baby, and the answer is you've got to really follow a diabetic diet because she's a diabetic. And I think this is not the time to go to a totally high-fat, low-carb lifestyle that may lead to ketosis. And I don't know what the ketosis ultimately, because that has to do with protein metabolism. I don't know if the ketosis will ultimately affect the baby adversely. So I'm going to sit on the side of the baby and say, look, you sit down and say, what can I do with carbs? What do I do with this? And I would follow what they say. Believe me, there's been so much research on this to try to produce a healthy child and a healthy outcome for a baby and a mom of a diabetic. I'm coming down completely on the side of the fetal maternal medicine people when it says, hey, this is not the time that you lose weight. Now, you may decide to maintain your weight, and you may decide you don't want to gain as much weight, and you may have to be very careful with how much you eat in terms of carbohydrates. But this is not the time that all of a sudden you eliminate some foods drastically and change others, because you may end up with a child that has other problems, that's too big. You may end up in a C-section, a bunch of other things. Pay attention to the doctors. There's good research on this. This has been thought out very well. And yes, you may not be doing any harm on your high-fat diet. On the other hand, you may not be doing any good for the baby. And the baby comes first.
Have a question for the good doc? He just may answer it on the air. That is, if you play your carbs right.
Oh, gosh.
Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. Or you can find us on Facebook.
And don't forget, or forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidrum. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For more information on Dr. Zorba Pastor and to listen to current or past episodes, go to ZorbaPastor.org. There you can subscribe to the weekly podcast, and you will find the show archive, Zorba's favorite recipes, his healthy living articles, and other helpful tips heard on the show. That's ZorbaPastor.org.